Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 1:09 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 2nd. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And what I thought we'd kick off with is just the short term, but we'll spin out into the long term. So you can see, for example, that the S&P 500 gapped lower today and then recouped a good part of the loss, gave it all back up again, went straight back all and recouped more than it had the first rebound, then gave up some more. And this is, I think, a graphic depiction of just how much indecision there is out there with regard to the outlook for additional stimulus, because stimulus is what has driven the recovery from the March lows. We've seen massive supplies of money coming through from just about every government. The total assets of central banks have expanded considerably. But what we've seen more recently is a reticence among central banks and governments to continue to supply money. And that was a big factor in what happened in the markets this week. So, for example, in Europe, the Europeans are disagreeing about just how to police the substantial amounts of money they promised that they would inject into the system. In the USA, you have a political impasse about what to do about fiscal stimulus. But then there's the additional point that the Federal Reserve said that they were going to supply the market with purchases of $120 billion worth of bonds every month. They said that back in May, and they haven't followed through because there hasn't been a need to. But what we've also, and this is, I think, the assumption that the market has been trading on now for 6 months and will likely continue to do so, because there is the clear belief that there is a Powell put. When we look at what happened over the course of the last 12 months, first we had the seizing up of the high yield market in the summer of 2019. That translated into the freezing up of the repo market, and that required the provision of $450 billion, and it was done instantly. So that helped to confirm that there was a Powell put, that the Federal Reserve was willing to do whatever was necessary to ensure money markets function correctly. And they are pretty much obligated to do that. There's no way that they could avoid doing that. But it also very clearly signaled to the money markets that the Federal Reserve is the de facto central bank to the world. The repo market dwarfs the size of the bond markets. It's enormous in terms of the quantity of money that flows around the world on a daily basis. And if the US dollar is to remain the reserve currency, there is just no way that the Federal Reserve could renege on its responsibility to ensure the proper functioning of that market. Well, then when we come around to this year and the response to the coronavirus, well, the Federal Reserve did introduce a massive amount of liquidity. And when we think about the fact that the central bank, total assets of central banks rose from 21 to 28 trillion, about half of all of that has been provided by the US, by the Federal Reserve. So there has obviously been clear evidence that they're willing to do whatever is necessary. But they said they were going to buy a ton of high-yield debt and in investment-grade bonds. In fact, they really haven't had to buy any. They said they were going to buy $120 billion in bonds, 80 in treasuries, 40 in mortgages back in May. They haven't had to buy any. And there are a number of other instances. There was the Main Street Lending Program, which is still not really firing because they just haven't felt that there is the need. But investors have been led to believe, and it's probably the right conclusion, that in the event that these measures are required, well, then the Federal Reserve will simply step in and provide them. So we have been offered a perspective on what their toolbook is likely to be in any future downturn. And it's open-ended, unlimited, and likely to be extraordinarily wide-ranging, because they have basically said they'll buy whatever you've got. They'll buy anything in order to ensure the correct functioning of the financial markets. So we've had a pause in stock markets, and part of the reason for that is because the size of the Fed's balance sheet has stopped going up. There's been a substantial moderation in the pace with which the total assets of central banks has been increasing. It's pretty much gone nowhere for all of September. At the same time, the dollar index rallied just about all of September, and then it pulled back over the last week. Now it's right in the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range. The impetus for additional weakness in the dollar will be almost entirely related to supply. So if additional stimulus is agreed, then it's quite likely that the dollar will take another leg lower. On the other hand, if the USA does not engage in additional stimulus and other countries do, well, then that would be reason for the US dollar to appreciate. When we look at this chart on a longer term basis, well, it's been in a volatile range now for more than 5 years. And it's towards the lower side of that range right now. So we do have some additional potential for some consolidation. But when we look at the size of the deficit and the funding requirements that the US has, not just now, but looking out into the future, then there is the clear scope that we're going to have substantial increases in the supply of currency. And one of the clearest and most sustained bullish arguments for the dollar, particularly in 2018 and 19, when sentiment towards the dollar was quite negative, was the supply argument. The Federal Reserve had been raising rates. They had been reducing the size of the balance sheet. That restricted supply. You restrict supply, the price goes up. It's really quite that simple. Well, we're just not in that environment anymore. So it's much more correct now, I think, to be bearish of the dollar and not to be too enthusiastic about its potential for an additional rally to be sustained. Doesn't mean that it can't go up in the short term, but the medium-term prognosis is more likely than not that we're going to see a weaker dollar overall. Well, a weaker dollar is something that will extend liquidity and credit to the rest of the world. So that is a positive from the perspective of global growth and the outperformance of emerging markets. And they have been in need of a catalyst, and a weaker dollar overall would certainly be a catalyst. Then when we look at the willingness of governments to run deficits. Well, the running total right now is about 1.5 trillion. Now, that's not quite as high as the 2.2 trillion figure that we had all the way back in July, but it's substantially above levels that we had ahead of the coronavirus. Now, one of the issues with looking at this data is that it's not updated even monthly, and different countries update their deficits figures at different times. But one thing we can certainly think about is there has been a substantial increase in deficit spending since 2018, and it is at highs that have not been seen in at least 20 years. In fact, the trend has been marching higher since the credit crisis, and it only just took another leap higher this time. So we might be on a new trading level. We might not see the deficit come back below $1 trillion for the global economy because of the very difficult environment that a lot of economies find themselves in at present. When we then think about what's going on in terms of stock markets, well, it's quite normal to see that its valuation expansion tends to be rather important at the beginning of a new trend. So we can see that multiple expansion has been responsible for the majority of the run-up from the troughs in this year. Then, when we think about the peak to trough, well, we did have some valuation contraction, but we've had much more valuation expansion in response to the massive monetary accommodation that we've had. Well, then when we think about what exactly has happened to the stock market, the S&P 500 had been, I think, trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner from 2009 onwards. And there were big ranges, and they were one above another. That definitely changed in March. We had a clear and sustained breakout for a few months. It was overbought, there's no question about that. Then it came rattling back down and broke down, and then moved to a new low. But then it rebounded, and it rebounded in a pretty emphatic fashion. Now, we've had a very substantial hit to economic growth, and that's going to take time to recover from. But we are certainly now moving back into a new, or we're in a new phase, because once you have the snap or the pullback and then the snapback, and we're now at the end of the snapback. So the question now is, what's going to happen next? It's quite normal for valuations to become extreme in a recession, because especially when prices start to rebound, it takes a while for earnings to start to recover. And it's the earnings recovery helps to drive a new bull market. So there's a lot of angst being expressed right now about valuations being too high. But those valuations are only too high if earnings do not improve. And then the question is, well, what is going to have to happen in order for those earnings to improve? Well, we're definitely getting a rationalization. There are some businesses that are just not going to come back. So I think that's obviously a significant factor. There are a lot of small businesses in particular have been very heavily impacted by the coronavirus, and I've been saying for months that the coronavirus can in many respects be viewed as an accelerant. So the retail apocalypse has been going on now for 7 or 8 years, and this is only going to accelerate it. And the other side of this equation, of course, is that the retail apocalypse has been going on for a decade. So, if businesses have survived this long and can come through the coronavirus in a reasonably steady manner, then because so many other businesses have gone bust, they're going to have more market share. Now, they may have to compete for market share with online businesses. And certainly, this has been a very clear acceleration, accelerant in terms of the ability of online businesses to do well. So, when, for example, we look at Macy's today is back on its lows, and it's a fraction of where it was back in 2015. So, in fact, it's down more than 90%. Obviously, this is a company that has got a very significant challenge. They're selling commoditized goods at a markup that is not justifiable, and they rely on footfall when many people can buy the exact same items elsewhere. And obviously, that's a very difficult scenario. But the other point is that they own a great deal of real estate. So then the question has to be asked when we look at, for example, the market cap of 1.8 billion. It is rather ridiculous because the headquarters of the company in New York City is probably worth that alone. If they were to sell off their real estate or redevelop the company, in fact, that was their recovery plan before the coronavirus. When the market was trading in here back in 2019, that's what Macy's recovery plan was, that they were going to start to transition to become a REIT, and that they would try and monetize their significant real estate holdings. Well, that plan was starting to get some headway with investors, and since then, the price has more than halved, and it's continuing to deteriorate. So obviously there are very significant challenges, but what this crisis is obviously also going to throw up are business opportunities. So there are going to be business opportunities on the retail front, but it's also worth considering that almost half of all retail business in New York, for example, is tourist driven. And brick and mortar businesses, particularly in major cities and tourist hotspots, are heavily dependent on travel to pad out their earnings. And that's going to be particularly true for survivors. So it's quite likely that it is businesses that can continue in a brick and mortar capacity and that can obviously have a draw for travelers and for tourists over generally are likely to survive. Then there are companies that have done particularly well from the bull market in e-commerce. So Etsy is one of those, and the share has rebounded really quite admirably over the last 2 weeks. So yes, it has had a somewhat larger pullback, but this is still an uptrend. And Etsy has done something that has been really beneficial for a lot of sellers, in that it has offered to advertise listings for its sellers for almost free. So then that takes care of the difficult social media marketing angle of an online business. And that has been enormously beneficial for Etsy over the course of the coronavirus period. Then, of course, we've got Shopify. Well, Shopify is a company that's trading on an extraordinary valuation, but it has also rebounded really quite admirably over the last 2 weeks, and it has unwound much of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. The surge in sales has, in fact, brought the estimated PE in to about 430. It was more than that. However, I also know, for example, I know someone who has been able to grow their Shopify business by 500%. He's turning over $1 million a month on his Shopify business. And Shopify is taking a leaf out of Amazon's book and offering vendor credit to its sellers. And they'll offer you as much credit as you turn over in a month. And all you need to do to receive those funds is simply click on a button. There are no, there is no paperwork, there is no meetings, there is nothing to really stop anyone from accessing credit. Well, obviously that is a massive loss leader for companies like Shopify, but what it does, of course, do is help to grow out the business. And it's these kinds of very capital-intensive business plans that thrive in a low interest rate environment. Now, it's exactly the same business model in many respects as Sunrun. Now, this share was in negative territory today, but it has rallied really quite spectacularly over the course of the last few months. And part of the reason for that is when you've got extraordinarily low interest rates, then the kind of vendor financing agreements that help to create customers become really very beneficial. So they can afford to put solar panels on people's roofs for no cost or no down payment, and they can afford to wait until residual income starts to flow through because interest rates are zero and they have the promise of an internal rate of return. That's exactly the same type of business model that Brookfield has used with its renewable energy investments as well. Because the private equity firm that is the parent has been able to borrow at extraordinarily low rates. They make that money available almost on an infinite supply for purchasing renewable energy utilities. Then, as that the cash flows start to flow through in a very steady manner, it's really a subscription business model. In fact, utilities are the ultimate subscription business model because people have to have electricity. Well, then they are able to capture their outsized internal rate of return. Then the company also gets to pay a dividend to its investors, and this is a virtuous circle. And these kinds of businesses, they tend to do extraordinarily well when we've got low interest rates. And that's likely to persist for as long as we do have low interest rates. Now, what I find rather interesting here is we've had some movement in terms of the government bonds. We've had a lot of geopolitical stress over the last 6 months. We've had a great deal of concern about the potential for inflation, the potential for misallocation of capital, and yet bond yields are going nowhere. The bond yield was steadier in here today, but it's been really up 1 week, down the next, and we're still trading today very close to where the lows were back in March. The Federal Reserve has basically told us they're not going to raise rates. Even if they were to see inflation, then they're going to wait until it is really well established. That suggests that it could be a while. It might be a year or two or even three before we see significant movement in interest rates. That pretty much ensures that we are likely to have a very significant risk-on appetite from international investors because they don't have a lot of choice. With 10-year bond yields at 0.7%, anyone that has got longer-term obligations has to capture a rate of return greater than 70 basis points. I did see a graphic, and I'm rather sorry that I didn't save it, but it was of the long-term trend of the Yale Endowment's allocations. What I found rather interesting is that it's almost entirely focused on private assets, whether that is real estate or venture capital, private equity, or then also investing in the commodities or those types of illiquid but interest rate sensitive high growth potential outcomes. Then they have a low weighting in domestic equity and they've been increasing their weighting in overseas equity. Now, one of the reasons that people tend to look at Yale's endowment is because it has been one of the most successfully run funds anywhere for a long time. But the reason they've been able to achieve that outperformance has been because of their focus on private equity in an environment where interest rates have been deteriorating. What's also particularly interesting is that when we think about the outlook for a number of the listed private equity firms, well, they didn't do much of anything during the period from about 2013 through to 18, but they did break out in 2019 and have subsequently rebounded and are at new highs. So even for some of the less well-performing private equity companies, they have tended to do better in an environment where we've got extraordinarily low interest rates. I think that is something where we can very clearly monitor the outperformance, but we have to be very also aware of the fact that this is where a bubble is evolving, that the willingness to invest in companies that don't make money, that are years away from turning a profit, that's only possible when you have zero interest rates and abundant credit. When interest rates eventually do rise, then those types of highly levered businesses are going to run into trouble. And the reality is that the longer the condition remains the case, the more likely it is that they will take on unsustainable leverage. So we're in the run-up of a bubbly environment within the private equity sector. It's just quite clear that when you have low interest rates for a prolonged period of time, it's inevitable that there's going to be misallocation. Now, when we then think about if that's where the bubble is, what about the conditions that are going to get us there? Well, on the one hand, we've got these massive deficits. And there's the question that I think has been outstanding for a long time is when are bond yields going to rise? I've been wondering about this correlation between the median age and the bond yield for a couple of years now, because there are strong correlations. And when we look at the average age in the USA and we compare it to the bond yield, well, then we would conclude, I think rightfully, that in order to see higher interest rates in a meaningful manner, we would need to see the average age rise. Well, the only way we're going to see the average age rise is if we get fewer older people and more younger people. Well, considering that birth rates are deteriorating, there was a baby boom was anticipated as a result of the lockdowns. We may not get that because of the availability of contraceptives. The easy way to boost the number of young people is immigration. Now, that is a hot button topic for the vast majority of countries, but there is also a clear correlation internationally. And this has been a graphic that I've been paying attention to now for nearly 2 years. Because if we look at the developed markets, then we have a clear correlation between the median age rising and the yield falling. And even in emerging markets, there is also this clear correlation. Now, one thing that could potentially upset that, and it's a big question, is what about China? China's yields are about 4%, and at least they were back when this graph was produced, which is nearly 2 years ago. But I do think that we have an interesting environment here, because whereas bond yields internationally have been completely static, Chinese yields have been trending higher. Now, China's markets are closed for Golden Week right now, so this chart is 2 days old, and it will not be updated for another 3 or 4 days. But the bigger picture here is that the yield had been trending downwards from about 2018, and it's now around 3.14. Now, there are a couple of different ways of thinking about this. Maybe inflationary pressures are rising in China. That might be one potential outcome, that if inflation was picking up, then it would be normal to anticipate that yields would rise as a reaction to that. So that's potentially an answer. Of course, there is an additional answer that we've seen. Stock markets taking a hit and the banking sector has been on the back foot. So maybe it is simply a desire among investors to raise cash and not to put it with the government either. And that would also push up interest rates and yields. But there's, I think, an additional point is that China is coming through the coronavirus better than other countries. and growth has been able to return to a stronger footing because of the severity of the lockdown that they enforced. They've been able to come through it in a quicker manner. Excuse me, I feel like I'm going to have to sneeze. I've been sneezing a lot recently because we've been having the aircon on. It's been unseasonably warm here. It's 100 degrees in Los Angeles yesterday. But these are interesting developments in the Chinese government bond. Excuse me. When we think about what's going on in China, then they have been able to come through this coronavirus with a clear focus on trying to develop the domestic economy. It's still very difficult to travel to China, so and it's impossible to get a new visa if you live in the USA because their embassies are closed. But there is international travel starting to pick back up again, and China and its domestic market is starting to recover. The big question is, how long is it going to take the rest of the economy to, or the global economy to get back into a growth footing, to start to absorb more of its exports outside of the PPE exports? But the bond yield may, in fact, be representative of the stronger economic growth that we're seeing in the economy. So I do believe, though, that this is a market we need to pay attention to, because the competition between the superpowers is only going to be amplified as time goes on. It's in the USA's interests to try and curtail the rise of China now before it becomes too strong. It's in China's interests to continue to strengthen and then to challenge the existing power into the end of the decade or at the beginning of the next decade. I do also think that I've often looked at the Dow gold ratio on an historic basis and thought that we would have a meaningful peak in about 2035. Now, that has been completely thrown out the window as a result of the coronavirus and the very significant move that we've had in the gold price. But one thing that is clear is we've seen peaks in the Dow gold ratio on increments of about 36 years. And when we look at the ratio over a long period of time, then there's about 36 years between the peaks, and each one of the peaks was higher than the last. And I'm not at all sure why I'm not getting more history coming through with this particular iteration. But the question that's outstanding is, do we anticipate from the Dow gold ratio? If it was going to hit a peak without the coronavirus taking hold, then it should find support and start rallying, and that gold would underperform. But we're just not seeing that. Instead, we're seeing gold outperform. So something has definitely changed in terms of the outlook for gold and the inverse correlation then with equities. When we then think about the secular bull market, well, I'm questioning then what this historical chart really tells us. We can see the big bull markets off the lows on this log scale legend. It would have been about 2036 that this ratio should arguably have hit a peak somewhere around the 70 mark. this has been a very significant break of trend. And gold prices continue to look like it's a consolidation. The gold price this week is holding right around the $1,900 level. Now, $1,900 is a significant level because it's in the region of the previous peak. So it's a natural area where we might anticipate that some support might be found, or indeed some resistance might be encountered following the break below it. So now the question is, are we going to see a further retracement back towards the mean, or is it going to rebound further and push back above the 2000 level in the short term? But from a long-term perspective, the question is it going to continue to outperform the Dow Jones? I do think that it's likely that gold will continue to at least perform in line, if not outperform, the Dow Jones, for the simple reason that the Dow has been rallying already for a good long 11-year period. It does look like it is finding support here in the region of the trend mean, and there is still potential for additional upside here, and not least if we start to see economic activities improving in the next quarter and into 2021. One thing, though, that's important to highlight is that we are in the fourth year of the U.S. presidential cycle, and the fourth year is generally not as good as the third year. If we can go back and look at the third year, we've had a really quite significant rebound. In fact, outside of a little pullback in May, June of 2019, the market really did not look back, and that was a good example of the third year being among the best in terms of performance. Now, usually the first year of the presidential cycle is the worst, and 2017 on this occasion was one of the best years in the cycle, but there was a clear exogenous shock, and that was the election of President Trump and giving the Republican Party a clean sweep in terms of control of both houses and the presidency, and they pushed through a very significant tax cut. So usually the first year of the presidential cycle is among the worst performers, and 2012 would probably have been sorry, was the fourth year. 2013 was in fact not a bad year either. As we look into 2021, the big question then is, are we going to get another exogenous shock? Are we going to get substantially more liquidity pumping up this market? And the, I guess, pieces may be beginning to fall into place for that, because every country in the world is going to be looking at reflation. And we're at a period in time where we've had accelerating factors in terms of just sweeping away large numbers of low-skilled jobs. And this is an acceleration of the kinds of trends that have been underway now for more than 20 years. So the big question for policymakers and governments and think tanks going forward is, how can an ill-educated person achieve a middle-class lifestyle? Because historically, they could have achieved a middle-class lifestyle by working in a factory. Factories generally tend to pay more. Working in mining or lumber or roughnecking in the energy sector. Or they could start their own business. So that would be for the entrepreneurial small minority of people that are willing to take those risks and can get access to funding. And then we have people that are drivers. There are a lot of people who drive goods, freight, and people around to their destinations. And then, of course, there was. So those were the primary ways of achieving a middle-class lifestyle. Well, manufacturing has experienced a death over the last 25 years in the USA, and even longer than that in the UK. When we think about the mining sector, coal has become anathema. So coal mining has been dying for much of the last 20 and 30 years as well. The only set part of the coal mining sector is metallurgical coal that is doing better. The oil sector is under severe stress right now, and oil prices this week pulled back below the $40 level on Brent crude, and we're down and finished on the lower side of the trading range for the day. So two significant downward dynamics in a day, or in this week, I should say, encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. There's certainly potential for lower trilateral ranging here. It's also putting downward pressure on energy shares. There's going to be a significant lack of demand for exploration going forward. Well, all of that suggests that the roughnecking and the kinds of people that are required to just put their bodies on the line to drill and bring production to market are there's going to be less demand for them when all of these previous routes have disappeared. Then the low-end services sector has picked up the slack, but generally speaking, those jobs pay less. So people working in retail or people working in the low-end services sector, like restaurants, then they don't generally get paid as well as someone who's working in a factory. And if you're lucky enough to work in a restaurant which is more high class, then you might get better tips or better other forms of compensation. But as a general rule, the low-end services sector is simply not paid as well. So we've had a downshift in terms of the ability of less well-educated people to be able to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. Whereas at the exact same time, technological innovation has improved so that you can achieve more with less. That has, in many respects, masked the inability of people to increase their wages over the course of the last 20 or 30 years because of technological innovation. But the problem is that technological innovation is now also biting into that large swathe of the population that has relied on low-end jobs for their income. So we've had obviously a very big hit to the people working in retail. The people working in high-end services are also now being laid off with increasing aggressiveness, particularly in the airline sector. Then when we start to think about, well, how is this going to eventually have an impact on the wider economy? I did see this, well, I was playing tennis earlier this week with one of the original writers of Star Trek: The Next Generation, and he was telling me about the new set they have for The Mandalorian. So this is really a quite profound background. It's this huge stage that is a massive arc that has the ability to project any background. Well, this is going to massively compress the cost of production. It means that there will be no need to travel. There'll be less need to stay on locations for long periods of time. And the, of course, issue is that the ability of Hollywood to spend in different locations around the country and the world has been a massive money spinner for local economies. If we think about, for example, New Zealand's ability to prosper as a result of the Fellowship of the Ring or the Lord of the Rings trilogy being filmed there, and that has become a significant tourist destination. Well, there'll be absolutely no need for that in future. It's exactly the same for the Game of Thrones in Northern Ireland. And why would they go on location to these countries, spend millions of dollars in various parts of the world, transport large numbers of people and equipment all over the world to get the scenes that they want when the whole thing can be projected onto a massive screen with a very clear picture and then the ability to do take after take with exactly the same background and where lighting can be completely controlled? Well, obviously, this is still new technology and it's really quite expensive to perform in. But the thing that he was telling me was that when he was working on the Star Trek Voyager set, they had a fiberglass version of the ship that they used for the first two seasons. It cost over $100,000 to produce, and they used it for all the shots of the ship. And at the end of the second season, it was put into a box and never used again because the technology had improved enough so that the graphics were just interchangeable with actual footage. Well, what this is just another example of is the way in which technology is improving and the quantity of data that is required to do this. I did get news from our programming people in here today about the chart library because that we've had difficulty getting it back into working order and updating all of our prices since our server crashed at the end of August. It's also a factor that has affected our ability to send out the free daily email. The reality is that the site now is has got approximately 3 terabytes of data, and that is pushing up against the limits of what's feasible. So we're quite likely going to have to migrate onto a whole new server infrastructure. And I'm just one person. I'm just one person producing a research service. Now, obviously, we have a lot of data as a result of what we're taking down from Bloomberg to create the chart library. And I'm recording videos every day, but those aren't even hosted on our site. But 20 years of the audio are hosted on our site. And I would like to elicit some feedback from subscribers as to whether they even still look at the audio anymore. Or do they listen to the audio, I should say, rather than simply looking at the videos? Getting back to the question of what it is that we can anticipate going forward, it's quite likely that a lot of the low-end services jobs are going to be outsourced to the internet. The growth of the digital economy is going to take over, because if the data of a person's labor can be replicated in the cloud, then there's no reason not to do that. If I can create an online shopping experience that is easier and cheaper than employing someone to fold clothes on a shop floor, why wouldn't I do that? These are, I think, very significant developments. It's another example of why the coronavirus has been an accelerant. It pretty much ensures that we're going to see massive monetary and fiscal stimulus remaining a factor for the foreseeable future, and that the gap between the ability of less well-educated people to earn a living, or I guess it's not even to earn, but to achieve a middle-class lifestyle is going to be further impugned, whereas the better-educated people, those that have got leveraged to the emerging economy that is digital in nature, are going to perform better. They're going to be in a better position. If the correlation between interest rates and the median age holds, if it's something that is in fact a market truth rather than an interesting coincidence, well, then we're not going to see interest rates rise in a meaningful fashion. The only way we're going to see inflation picking up and at interest rates rising on a sustained basis is if the velocity of money picks up in a big way. But in order for the velocity of money to pick up, then we would need to see a sea change in the way that the economy is functioning. And obviously, the reason why emerging markets and younger populations have higher interest rates is because of the dynamism of young populations and their need for new stuff to create their own independent life. So that does represent a significant question. When we then think about the gold price, well, gold tends to do well in a negative real interest rate environment. Of course, the biggest question outstanding for investors is what exactly is an accurate inflation measure? Because we haven't got a really good way of measuring inflation any longer. The overpowering influence of semiconductors and the digital economy is practically impossible to capture in an accurate way for inflation measures. But if we look at the lower living standards that many people have encountered as a result of higher asset prices, higher property prices, higher energy prices and insurance prices and service prices, then the additional point that there is a continuing evolution of a subscription business model, where I've seen a number of new startup companies with electric vehicles that they don't anticipate selling the cars at all. They want to do an entirely subscription business model for vehicles. Well, again, this is the environment that we're in, that low interest rates push up asset prices because we've had a hollowing out of the middle class. The ability of people to make an upfront purchase, like putting down the money to buy a car or a house, has certainly deteriorated, and then they are able to access these types of services through very incremental payments. Well, that's likely to continue as long as we have low interest rates. It's the low interest rate environment that creates the ability of these capital-intensive business models to proliferate. Now the question is, how long is it going to take for this inflation question to become realizable? Because there are plenty of countries in the world that do have large populations and a lot of debt. And it's quite likely that we're going to see inflationary pressures rise in places like China or India first, and perhaps then start to infect everywhere else. One thing we know for certain, though, is that central banks in the rest of the world are not going to raise interest rates until they have inflation. So they're creating a negative real interest rate environment, and that is going to remain the case for as long as it takes for inflation to come back, because their debt mountains are extraordinarily high. The willingness and ability of populations to accept the austerity required to pay that back is zero. And therefore, they're going to have to come up with a different way to erode those debt mountains. Eventually, it could end in war. When the debts become so extraordinary, then eventually they will get settled by default on behalf of the loser and inflation on behalf of the winner. Well, that is, I think, a long-term potential outcome. And perhaps in 10 years or even 15 years, it would become highly relevant. In between now and then, it's quite likely that we're going to see gold continue to outperform because of that risk over the long term. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.